It's time for the Million Pound Radio Show, and here are your hosts, Andy Hamilton and Nick Rebel.
Well, welcome to the show, and in tonight's show we'll be looking at the problem of rats on the London Underground. Just how many are there, and should they be forced to give up their seats for old people?
And we'll also be giving £1 million to any Home Office forensic scientist who can tell the difference between soap and high explosive. So our money should be pretty safe there. Yeah,
well, we are very pleased to be back for another series, aren't we, Nick?
Oh, yes, we certainly are.
Yes, we're very pleased indeed to be back on the airwaves, and I'm especially pleased because, personally, I'm deeply, deeply committed to the idea of radio as a medium and to have the opportunity to do 6 shows on the BBC who I regard as the best, frankly. It's just wonderful. Basically, what I'm trying to get across is that...
You've got financial problems.
No. Well, a bit, yes. I mean, my relationship with my bank has deteriorated slightly. I mean, they used to send me letters which began, "Dear Mr. Hamilton," now they start them, "Oi, you." Yeah. And when I walk into the bank, the manager does come out and sing, "Who's the wanker in the red?" But, you know, apart from that, financially speaking, cash flow-wise and insolvency terms, everything's pretty sound, really. Have you seen my security blanket?
You ate it just before we came on.
Oh, yeah. You don't mind if I suck my thumb then, do you?
Honestly, Andy, you've just got no idea, have you, how to handle your financial affairs?
Oh, and you do, I suppose. Nick Revel, the wizard financier who won £50,000 on the pools at Christmas and invested the lot in Baghdad Holidays, PLC.
Yeah, and when I realised it was a mistake, I sold the shares and reinvested the money.
In Polypec, Tottenham Hotspur, and the DeLorean Space Project.
Yeah. Well, don't worry, my finances are secure now. I've got all my savings in an account in the Nationwide.
All right, well, that sounds sensible, yeah? That's good. Well, presumably you researched which building society to go for.
Of course I did, Andy. Right. I did exhaustive research. I watched all the Building Society adverts, and theirs was definitely the best.
You decided on the basis of a TV ad?
Yeah. You know, the one with the white-haired bloke writing to his son in Africa? "I only hope that you have gone to learn to swim with the sharks and dolphins."
Yeah, well, if he swims with the sharks, he won't get to swim with the dolphins. Do the dolphins first. That's the only thing he'll learn. What a load of bollocks that is.
It's an ad that reflects the caring 90s.
Well, what's caring about it? I mean, what sort of father is he? "Go play with a shark, son. When you come back with your legs bitten off, don't worry, I've opened a nice little account for you at the Nationwide." Well, tonight, Nick and I are examining that age-old question, just what is sexual attraction? Now, Professor Susan Hughes, you're an expert in the field of animal behaviour. What is sexual attraction?
Well, at its most basic level, it's the biological interaction which ensures the survival of our species. Mm-hmm. In fact, as a scientist, I would argue that primarily sex is a conservation measure.
Except, of course, that humans don't just have sex to breed, do they? I mean, humans often have sex just for the pleasure.
So I'm told. Although, personally, I find that hard to believe. You see, the problem is that human beings have mentally separated sex from its purely biological function.
I see, yeah.
The human has introduced irrelevancies like eroticism, satisfaction, fantasy, role-playing. It's all nonsense. I mean, in the wild, you don't see a stag dressing up as a vicar and then asking the dead to have a kid out of his son, do you?
No, I can't say I've seen that.
Exactly. And if you're not careful, this over-elaboration of the act of reproduction will spell extinction for mankind, as it did for the dodo, which we now know became extinct after being introduced to sadomasochistic spanking games.
Right, well, something to think about there. Now, Desmond Morris, world-famous...
They all know who he is, Andy. They know what he does for a living. It's okay, don't worry.
Desmond Morris, what are the physiological indicators of sexual attraction?
Well, basic body language tells us when people are sexually attracted. For instance, take that woman in the 8th row there. Now, she is clearly sexually attracted to the man sitting next to her. Mm. Well, we can tell this because her body is, in fact, angled slightly towards him. Her fingers are extended. Pupils of her eyes are dilated. And perhaps most significantly of all, she's got her thighs around his head.
I see what you mean, yeah.
Now, you're probably wondering what is the psychological mechanism that triggers sexual attraction?
Hmm? Sorry, I was a bit distracted there. Can't work out how she's doing that. But,
I was talking about the mental side of sexual attraction.
Right, yeah.
Now, much research indicates that what we are looking for in a sexual partner is somebody who physically resembles oneself.
So you're saying that people want to have sex with someone who looks like they do?
Yes.
It's a bit rough on Peter Beardsley, isn't it?
Well, obviously he wouldn't find someone who looks like he does, but if you look at Rod Stewart, it would explain why his women are usually blonde and thick with nice bottoms. Although attraction is largely subjective, there are classically good-looking individuals. For example, Richard Gere and Michelle Pfeiffer, to whom almost all the opposite sex is attractive.
Yes, now, I mean, that's funny, because personally I find I'm more drawn to people who are attractive, but not what you'd call conventionally good-looking.
Yes, that's what ugly people usually say.
With respect, I wouldn't class myself as ugly. In fact, my wife says my face is interesting.
Oh, I see. She's an anthropologist, is she?
Well, no. I mean,
yes, as a scientist, I find your face interesting as well.
Yes, me too. Especially the cranial similarities with a gorilla.
Yes, that is a flower.
Yeah, I think we've gone off at a bit of a tangent, actually. Now, Dr. Morris, perhaps we could proceed to this experiment that you've set up with Nick.
Well, certainly. Now, this is designed to illustrate the dominance of the sex urge in the human male.
Right.
You see, it's been proved that all men think about sex every 12 seconds. Except for Warren Beatty, who just does it every 12 seconds. I'm attaching this monitoring system here to Nick's head, and this will pick up the electrical impulses from his brain and translate them so that we can actually hear Nick's thoughts. Are you all right, Nick?
Yep, fine. This thing won't damage my brain, will it?
Sorry. Sorry, amusing concept.
Okay, machine on. Here we go. Any second now, we should hear what's going on inside Nick's mind.
I think you're tuned into his intellect there.
I'll adjust the tuning. Aha! You need to hear something.
Blimey, this is a boring interview. That Desmond Morris talks absolutely. Oh, Michelle Pfeiffer in a wet T-shirt. Look rubbish. And I don't suppose for a moment this stupid machine is working. It's all a load of me and Kathleen Turner in the back of a car with her legs on.
See, every 12 seconds?
Yes. He's right about Andy being ugly, though. He's... Ooh, Rhodes Boyson. A black leather catsuit. Where was I? Oh, yeah, a supermarket and... Yes, Lassie, take me now!
You switched the machine off.
Yes, it was just getting interesting.
Well, I was worried I was going to throw up.
Are you feeling okay, Nick?
Yeah, fine. What are you looking at me like that for, Andy?
Just stay away from me, okay? You need help, you do. Well, thank you, Dr. Morris and Professor Susan Hughes, for those fascinating insights into sexual attraction, and now...
Hey, you couldn't actually hear anything, could you, when I had that contraption on my head, eh?
Nick, we heard you fantasising about Rhodes Boyson in a black leather catsuit.
Oh, well, that's all right, as long as there wasn't anything that made me seem abnormal.
Just get away from me, you're repulsive.
What's up? What's the matter?
Touch me and you're a dead man.
Well, I'm afraid we've had to leave the million-pound radio show as one of the presenters has been revealed as a pervert. Something of a surprise. I always presumed they were both perverts. So, in the meantime, here's episode 3 of Black Skull.
The year is 1631, and the Spanish Main is being terrorized by that most barbaric of pirates, Captain Black Skull. A man who rules his ship through tyranny and terror.
Now listen here, you scurvy sons of dogs. Round the next bay be a galleon full of Spanish doubloons, bound for Hispaniola. Only it ain't gonna get there, see, because we're gonna board it and slit the gizzards of the crew till the bilges are awash with our blood, and then we helps ourselves to the gold. What do you say, me hearties? Shall we go cut some throats? Ha ha!
No, Captain.
What do you mean, no?
I means no, Captain.
We don't like the way you're running this here ship, and we reckons we ain't gonna stand for it no more. Reckons we've had enough, ain't we, boys?
That's right,
yeah. We've had enough. Oh, I gets it, you stinking swabs. You wants a bigger share of the loot, does ya?
No, Captain.
Then I suppose you wants my treasure map, which shows where I buried the treasure from the Portuguese man of war.
No, Captain.
Then what do you want?
We wants a training day.
A training day?
Summer, we wants a training day, preferably in a nice hotel near Hastings. Where all us sea dogs can sit us down and pool our experience, compare work methods, and prioritize objectives, damn your eyes.
Prioritize objectives?
And improve our communication skills.
That's right. There's not a man on this ship what knows how to use any tense apart from the present.
That's because you're pirates. And ever since pirates begins, pirates only speaks in the present tense, does pirates. First man on this ship as uses the past or pluperfect tense, dies where he stands.
He was there.
Or a conditional. And the next one what mentions trading days is keel-hauled, dragged beneath the ship till the barnacles rip open his belly, and death comes as a merciful blessing.
Well, that's no way to motivate people, is it?
Don't you start, first mate.
Threatening to rip open the bellies of your staff? Call that man-management?
Well, he's no real managerial grounding, see? He was a plain midshipman originally. He should go on a course or something, you know.
Quiet, you insolent lovers!
Well, give us our training days. How else are we supposed to meet the challenges of the 1640s?
I'm an occupational health officer.
Aye, and a creche.
Silence! Any more of your mutinous whining and I'll rip out your eyes and feed them to the sharks. I'm the captain here, and this ship be mine, do you hear? Mine! Mine!
On Captain Kidd's ship, we get to do role-playing.
Shut up!
All get to do each other's job for a day. Got a new captain now. Bolton Harris liked being captain so much, he had your captain thrown overboard.
Well, here's some role-playing. I'll play the captain, and you play a man who's about to be stabbed.
Sipoy! It's Spanish galleon!
Now listen here, you filthy dogs. That there galleon is full of gold, and we be pirates. And pirates don't need training days. All pirates needs is a black heart and a sharp cutlass. What do you say, lovers? Will you follow your captain as we storm that there galleon?
We'll be there with you.
Because pirates is bold and brave and lives for the moment, see? So in a moment, we sails alongside that there galleon, swings across on our boarding ropes, cuts the throats of any Spanish soldier what stands in our way, and then loads ourselves up with silver and gold. And then we piles up all the treasure on the main deck, and then we counts it, doubloon by doubloon, jewel by jewel. And then, once we know how much booty we've gained through our deeds of black-hearted, blood-soaked evil, we'll gather it all up and invest it in a nice little pension scheme. What do you say, me hearties?
A nice little pension scheme!
Well, you can hear episode 4, where the pirates object to the black spot as a form of dismissal procedure, at the same time next week. Tonight at 10:30, it's the science programme, and they'll be talking to an astronomer who claims he can prove there are intelligent beings on other planets, because they've never contacted this one. And also, they'll be revealing how British troops built up an immunity to Iraqi chemical weapons by swimming in the North Sea and drinking London tap water. But now I understand we can return to the Million Pound Radio Show.
Welcome back. Later in the show, we'll be meeting the academic who has discovered that Rip Van Winkle, the man who slept for 20 years, had a season ticket at Arsenal.
The Arsenal fans have woken up in the audience. And we'll be looking at the success of the advertising slogan, "Don't let a fire be your fault," and its planned follow-up, "Start a fire and blame it on somebody else." But first...
Oh, by the way, you should know this. We've got a new Prime Minister, apparently.
Eh?
Mrs. Thatcher isn't Prime Minister anymore. It's some other bloke.
Yeah, Nick, we've had a new Prime Minister since November.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
I only noticed the other day, I turned on Prime Minister's Question Time and I thought, oh, Joe 90. So what's this new Prime Minister's name then?
Oh, for goodness sake. Honestly, his name is... It's gone. I wrote it down somewhere before I came out. John Major. Yeah,
right,
yeah.
I better write that down somewhere. John Major. What's he like then?
Well, seems like a nice enough bloke. You know, minds his own business, doesn't go out much.
Mm-hmm. What's he do for a living?
Don't know. Someone said he used to have a job modelling clothes in Burton's shop window. Oh, and apparently when he was a child, he was someone else's imaginary friend, you know. But...
So how did he get the job then?
Oh, Thatcher chose him.
Yeah.
He's a friend of a friend, I think. Uh-huh. She met him on holiday or something. But, I mean, he's only a stopgap, obviously, till they get someone halfway decent.
Oh, well, I realise that. Yeah. So what happened to Thatcher then?
Finally went mad. It's all being hushed up. Apparently, right, halfway through a cabinet meeting, she went for Kenneth Clark's throat with a razor blade.
What? And that's mad.
Well, true. Now, I get your point. But then, right, she bit William Waldegrave, and by the time they got the muzzle on her, she had half of Douglas Hurd's ear in her mouth, apparently. Blood everywhere. But they kept it all quiet, pretended to have a vote, and said she lost because of the poll tax.
But well, I saw her on telly the other day at a public meeting. You
know? Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, they've returned her into the community, haven't they? You know. Look at her eyes, mate. She's drugged up to the eyeballs. And Mark follows her everywhere just to make sure she doesn't get hold of any sharp objects. You know?
Yeah. In a sense, you know, it's sad, really, yeah. Isn't it? You know, to see her down so low now and scorned and ridiculed. It's very sad.
It's very sad.
Don't you set me off.
No, you set me off.
And now it's time for How to Annoy. This week, How to Annoy Edwina Curry.
Excuse me, aren't you Theresa Gorman? Tell you what, Andy, I hope Edwina Curry doesn't think that was about her.
Oh, no.
Later on, we'll also be discussing the role of theatre in society, how it provides a forum for moral debate, an arena for cathartic spectacle, and somewhere for vain, bitchy people to show off in front of big crowds.
I got a new neighbour this week.
Yeah, what's he like? All right.
Yeah, middle-aged bloke. He seems okay. He's a bit grumpy, though. I don't think he likes kids.
No?
No, he got very narked with our two. I mean, I tried to explain that Pip's three and Robbie's not even one, you know. So they're too young to understand about electricity, you know. But he seemed to think they'd electrify the fence deliberately. I mean.
Well... Has he got kids?
Nah.
Oh, well, there you are.
Yeah, I feel sorry for him, really, because he's missed out on a lot of fun, you know. Mind you, he probably wouldn't see it like that after the business with the model airplane, you know.
Model airplane?
Yeah, well, Pip was out playing with his model airplane, and the radio signal started interfering with this bloke's pacemaker, you know, so... And he's leaping around, you know, right. Head jerking, legs kicking, arms flailing everywhere, you know. I would have called an ambulance, but I thought he was just amusing the kids, you know? I mean,
obviously.
Because they were laughing, you know, and... I didn't really get suspicious till I heard Pip say, let's see if I can make him turn a somersault, you know? Anyway, this bloke took it all very badly, threatened legal action, you know?
Blimey. Yeah. Well, some people have just got no sense of humour, have they?
No, I couldn't be like that.
Nah, me neither.
No, you're laughing, you. Anyway, so...
Everyone on this row, move up one, please. Okay. I don't want to climb over you all.
Uh-oh, Nick, I think we got a loony.
Where?
All right, look, the woman in the mink coat and the pearls, OK?
Oh, no.
If your anarchist friends were here, they'd string her up, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Plow on, OK?
Well, right. Don't all stare at me. Get on with the show. Let's have some jokes.
Look, keep going. Do the tab,
OK? Right, I will. Yeah, OK. Well, ladies and gentlemen, have you noticed that since the Commons passed that law to hunt down Nazi war criminals, Norman Tebbit's been keeping a very low profile?
Nick, wait a minute, does she know you?
No, no.
What? Shut up! Speak up. Tell him to project, Nick.
She does know you.
No.
God, where did you get this audience? I haven't seen such a bunch of unwashed hippies since we had that pop festival back at the house in the 60s. Remember that, Nick?
Remember that, Nick?
She's my great aunt, Constance.
Uh-huh.
I like the one who played the guitar with his teeth. What was his name, Nick?
Jimi Hendrix.
That's right. ordinary looking chap. If I'd been 30 years younger, I'd have ridden the bugger.
Now, am I to understand you have relatives with a house big enough to hold a pop festival in?
Oi, half pint, I said project. When on stage, project.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry, your ladyship.
There's no need to be formal, and if you must, it's your grace.
Your grace.
Your grace, what, she's a bishop, is she?
No, a duchess. Mm.
I was just saying, Your Grace, that I'm surprised that Nick has such upper-class relatives.
Oh, yes, well, he tries to keep quiet about it for the sake of his, well, what's the phrase he uses?
Street credibility.
That's the one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, can we get on, please? I hate to break it up, but we're supposed to be entertaining.
This is entertaining, Nick. Because, you know, like, you've always gone on about growing up in a Yorkshire pit village.
Oh, he didn't, grow up in that village. But he owns that village. No, he grew up in Gloucestershire and St Moritz.
St Moritz.
It was the rough end of St Moritz.
I say, you there, Stumpy. You're not going to do any jokes about the royal family, are you?
Well, actually, yeah, Nick is the one with the bee in the bonnet about the royal family, OK?
That's because he's never forgiven Andrew for beating him up that time.
Well, Andrew, you mean Prince Andrew?
Yes, that's right. They always used to play croquet in the summer holidays at Balmoral. And one evening there was a huge argument, turned into a fight, and Andrew gave young Nicky here a proper hiding.
Aunt Constance, what a vivid imagination you have.
I can see him now, running toward the Queen, bleeding over the corgis, shouting, Aunt Lilibet, Andrew shoved my head through a hoop. It was a terrible whinger. Then he used to go all weepy and blush.
A bit like now, in fact.
Yes. Anyway, don't let me hold you up, Nick. Get on with it.
Well, this has all been very interesting.
Yeah, I'm telling you, Andy, that was all pure fantasy. She's making it all up.
Oh, yeah.
And anyway, Andrew only won that fight because his private detective joined in.
Well, later, we'll be looking at speculation that the government have caved in to the tobacco industry after the warning on cigarette packets is changed to smoking can damage your health, but my uncle lived till 90 and he was a 60-a-day man. But first...
And now, the £1 million radio show, in association with South West Water, the paint stripper from the tap, brings you the truth behind the truth.
Truth. What is it? How do we recognise it? Will the truth always out? What if it doesn't want to be outed? What if it's agoraphobic? Is honesty the best policy, or should you go for third party, fire and theft? Should we admire those who tell the truth, like the young George Washington with his cherry tree?
George Washington, did you chop down this cherry tree?
I cannot tell a lie, Father. It was I who did this deed.
No, son. How do you expect to become president like that?
The search for truth has inspired man since the dawn of civilization. He has sought to fathom the great questions of human existence. Does man have a soul? What is the meaning of life? Did Jeff Hurst's shot cross the line? Some moralists maintain that it can be justifiable to bend the truth. Professor Peter Parfitt, lecturer in the humanities at York University, explains.
There are many classic dilemmas in which we choose not to tell the truth for perfectly moral reasons. For instance, how many of us have spared an ugly person's feelings by telling them that their face is interesting? Or how many of us have told someone that the cheque is in the post? Or that we... only want to have sex with their ostrich for research purposes. These are the little lies that we all tell at some time or another.
Well, putting Professor Parfitt's view to one side for a second, why is it that certain truths remain constant? For instance, why are England always 81-6 by lunch? Propaganda, of course, is a negation of the truth. It was in Hitler's Germany that Goebbels pioneered this distortion of information and images. Such was Goebbels' skill as a propagandist that to this day many surviving Nazis believe they won the war and that the Führer is on an extended sabbatical. Of course, propaganda flourishes most easily under repressive dictatorships.
Here is the news from Baghdad this day, February 7th, 1991. Our magnificent leader, Saddam Hussein, has announced another emphatic victory for our heroic forces in their battle with the armies of the great Satan, George Bush, and John...
Major.
Such was the scale of the heroic victory that our heroic forces immediately withdrew 100 miles for victory celebrations in a bunker deep beneath the ground, so as not to upset local residents with the loud music. More good news. There has been a massive increase in tourism. Government officials today announced that over 100,000 foreign tourists have entered Iraq in the last 36 hours alone. And a similar upturn is expected in the building trade, especially in the area around Basra. Sport, just one football result. Jordan 6, Iraq 0. So another victory for Iraq there.
In war, truth is always the first casualty. Well, that's not true, actually. A soldier is usually the first casualty, but never mind. But ultimately, truth is something that is never completely attainable by we mere mortals. For spiritually, the possession of the absolute truth that knows all can only be ascribed to some form of deity, a godhead, a supreme being, or London taxi driver.
That's all for tonight, except to say that condom manufacturers in the United States test their products on two robots that can make love non-stop for up to 24 hours a day. This guarantees the condoms are strong enough to be used anywhere in the world, except, of course, in Yorkshire.
Nick's from Yorkshire, Eddie. And also, next week, London Weekend Television will be unveiling their new blockbuster show for Saturday nights. It's called Blind Beetle, where members of the public blind Jeremy Beadle. Good night.
Good night.
The Million Pound Radio Show was written and presented by Andy Hamilton and Nick Rebel, with Felicity Montague and Jasper Jacob. It was produced by Paul Mayhew Archer.